Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. Today is June 2nd, 2019, just in case you're listening to this at a different day. Sometimes we play things on the archive, like we did today. So our guest today is Lawrence Mead. Sorry, I made him a doctor. He's a professor, so that's close enough. But I think you're going to like this. It's going to be an interesting hour for you. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
So I changed it up a little.
Yeah, that's right.
Feels like you forgot to introduce yourself. I was like, no.
Who the heck are you?
I don't know. I just changed it around.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's boring, and everybody already knows what we're going to say, and they don't listen.
Keep them guessing.
Yeah. So the program is We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. The handy part of the website, for one, is all the guest information is there. And if you're thinking, wow, how come they're not on this other channel and this other station and this other show, blah, 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 all the information on how to book them is also on there, which is good. And you can also find the archive of the programs that we have done for the past 10 years that are all listed commercial-free for your listening enjoyment and doesn't cost you a cent. So, a lot to be grateful for there. Thanks, Robert, for all your hard work. All right, so let's jump right into this because I think this is a really interesting topic, and we have never spoken to Lawrence Mead before. He's a professor of politics and public policy at New York University, and you're thinking, oh, man, the guy's from New York. He's going to be a crackpot. No. No, he's not.
We got that out of the way.
I grew up in Connecticut. See, it's really good when people like you are on because it's like, no, not everybody back there is a crackpot. He is the author of a new book called Burdens of Freedom. Subtitle is Cultural Difference in American Power. And he's been a visiting professor at Harvard, Princeton, and the University of Wisconsin. Had a little cheese before we came here. Every time I hear the word Wisconsin, I like my mouth starts, you know, thinking about cheese. Also been a visiting fellow at Princeton and at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. So frequent media guest. He's been on all sorts of giant radio programs, just like this one. And, oh, gosh, we've been in the New York Times again. We won't hold that against you. Washington Post, The Economist. He's an expert on the problems of poverty and welfare in the United States. And among academics, he was the principal exponent of work requirements in welfare, the approach that now dominates national policy. And, you know, we love our friend Stephen Manfredi because he sends us all these fun authors. And I did list the questions that he gave us, so just in case we were complete knuckleheads.
That's what I'm here for. I'm here to keep you on track.
He did give us 10 fun questions to ask you, but we don't actually have to do that if we don't want to. We do have an hour with you, so we're happy to do this however you would like. And do you go by Lawrence, or are you a Larry?
Larry's fine.
You're a Larry. See, because we have a William call me Bill, so I'm like, we might have a Lawrence call me Larry. So
yeah.
All right, well, this really sounded like a very timely book, for starters. Something that we really should be thinking about, you know, individualism versus collectivism. And we're fighting about that a lot, although I'm not sure people put it in that context.
Well, I don't think that they probably mean by collective something different from what I mean by it. I'm primarily interested in the contrast between an individualist culture and a collective-minded culture where people don't think that they're individuals. That's not really about politics or policy. So a collective society with a big government, collective in that sense, could still be an individualist society in a cultural sense. And I think on the whole, that is the case with the United States. We do have a sizable government that many view as collective, excessively big or whatever, and there's a lot of political conflict about how big government should be. But that isn't really my focus. My focus is on whether the culture is individualist or collective, and especially whether it's becoming more collective-minded.
Right.
That is my main concern.
Yeah, we've always been an individualist culture, I think.
I mean, and
but it's changing.
But not in the way that I think a lot of our detractors say, well, you guys are all about the individual thinking that we don't care about other people.
No.
Caring
about other people is an important aspect of individualism.
Right.
We have a moralistic sense of right and wrong, and one of the dictates of that moralism is to care about people in trouble, and we feel we should help them, and we want government to help them. So that isn't, the individualism doesn't mean that government doesn't care. It does, however, place a premium on people helping themselves. And these things are not seen in conflict. If you're helping yourself, then you become more deserving, and you might ask more from government than if you weren't helping yourself. And that actually is the way the public views it. The public is upset by welfare programs, not because they're costly or because they're helping people, but because they don't expect people to help themselves. Well, they want there to be reciprocity. So that's where you see the characteristic moralism.
Sure, and I think people are also frustrated that, you know, for instance, we have a huge gap on how we deal with our veteran population in this country. And then you match that up to how we're dealing with our illegal immigrant population, how we're dealing with our prison population. And so we're looking at, you know, some people are literally riding for free. Other people have made sure that other people can ride for free, and they're getting nothing. It's like, wait a second. So there's a fundamental sense of fairness, I think, built in, baked into our cake.
Yeah, Americans care that everyone bears what I call the burdens of freedom. They have to bear the responsibilities that go with living in a free society. And those things include helping yourself, figuring out your own direction, doing what you can to help yourself, and so on. Above all, living out your own goals. That's primarily what individualism means. And we become uneasy when we encounter people who are more passive, who seem not to care about that, who are going with the flow, who live from day to day. They're engaging in survival, not engaging in achievement. That is what disturbs us. That is the way of the non-Western world. And that has its own virtues, but that isn't what America's about on the whole.
No, and I think that's also what freaks people out about the idea that we have a group of people in the 20-something age range, typically, who have decided, well, let's see, I went to school and I, you know, I actually have a college degree, and I could go get a job, but I think I'm just going to live on the street. I think I'm just going to sit around and, you know, do nothing and enjoy my life and get what I can for free.
Well, if you decide that you want to live a certain life and it comes out in that direction, then that actually wouldn't be counter to an individualist idea of what life's about. We all seek to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, to use a biblical phrase. We try to find the way that is best for us. And the struggle to find your way forward on your own is actually crucial to the society's dynamism. It's that quality that creates ferment, change, improvement, various shifts in opinion about things. Society is not stable because everyone's working out their way forward. And so that the struggle to find your way is really crucial to the society's dynamism. And whereas that isn't what you find in the non-Western world, those societies are not dynamic. They're stable. They tend to defer to authority. People have an idea of what life requires of them, and they follow that. They don't seek out their own idea of what life requires of them. So the society doesn't engage in constant, broad-based improvement. That isn't the thing that goes on. There can be improvement. There can be change, but it's dictated by the leaders. The leaders decide to change a certain direction, and that's where the society goes. But in the West, the dynamism is from the bottom up, and the leaders on the whole are leading others who have already moved in a certain direction. So that's why society in the West has always been so much more productive than is characteristic of the rest of the world.
There's just so much behind all that. And there's so much to think about. Okay, Stephen's first question is a pretty good one. You know, why did you write the book? Let's do that when we come back from our break. Because, now we're curious about it. He was right. We should have started with his questions.
No.
But see, he told us to do it. You know, I mean, it was right there, like directions. And so, of course,
There goes your individualism. I'm going to do it my way.
My natural inclination is, well, heck, we don't need these stupid things. Oh, my gosh. We will be back with our guest, Larry Mead. We're going to call him Larry. And you are a doctor. Yeah. I read the bottom of your bio. You have a PhD.
Yeah.
So he is a doctor.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be back with Dr. Mead. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
But good. They want you.
Ultimate song for the individual. All right, Dr. Mead, why did you write the book?
Why did I write it?
Yeah.
Well, mainly to work out some answers to questions I've struggled with for a long time. The three that are most important, first of all, poverty in America, especially long-term poverty. I spent much of my career figuring out how to deal with that. It's a mystery why people can be poor for a long time in a rich country where jobs are available. We don't really have a good explanation for that, at least not in terms of social barriers. I came to the conclusion that basically poverty of this sort is really due to cultural difference. Most of those who are poor long term come from the non-Western world. And what we're seeing here is an example of surviving behavior, where people are just getting through the day. They're not pursuing a goal. They don't see themselves as in charge of anything or going anywhere. And it's that temperament, that passive reactive temperament, which is actually the main reason that they're poor. I'm not saying that isn't understandable coming where they're from, or rather coming from. But it doesn't get you anywhere in America. This is not the way most Americans live. And if you try to live that way, you don't get very far.
Right.
So that's
right.
The point. That's the first thing. The second thing is the problem of immigration, where we have dealt with large numbers of people coming into the country, and we're having a much, much harder time assimilating those groups than we did 100 years ago when we had the previous large-scale wave of immigration. And the difference is, I think, that the previous wave came mostly from Europe, and so the people were coming in with an individualist viewpoint. So they understood life as a project. They understood that when they came to America, they had to work out a direction and make their own way. And so that was why they assimilated rather easily. Today's Inuits, however, are coming mostly from the non-Western world, chiefly from Asia and Latin America. And in those societies, you don't have an individualist temperament. You have people who think life is about survival, who don't have long-term goals, who orient more to outside constraints and demands than they do to their own direction. So they bear what I call the burdens of necessity. They're really not bearing the burdens of freedom. And so that's why they have a hard time in America. They really encounter difficulties which are, I think, explicable from cultural difference. And the third issue is the problem of failed states. One of my main interests in graduate school a long time ago was to figure out how countries that are new, that have just come out of the European empires and become independent countries, what's going to happen to them politically. Back then, we assumed that they would progress towards Western forms of government, they would become democratic, they would have strong institutions. It wouldn't happen overnight, but there would be progression in this direction. Well, this hasn't happened. Many countries in the developing world are worse off today than they were under the empires. The quality of government is poor, and in the worst cases, countries are literally falling apart. They can't govern themselves. There's chaos. You see this in Somalia, for example. How does that happen? How is it that those countries are unable to govern themselves, whereas the Western world has had strong government for a very long time? We've had good government. And there's almost no country, only a few countries outside the Western world, which are really well governed at all. So there's something there, too, that I think is due to cultural difference.
So getting back to your second point there about immigration and folks coming in, and most of those are going to fall in the lower income scale.
The way we have it now.
With a non-individualism attitude. And you couple that with our social structure and social welfare programs, doesn't that hinder them even more and make it almost impossible for them to get out of that, I don't know, line of thinking?
Well, a lot of people think that, and I used to think that myself. I used to be one of those who criticized welfare for making it easy for people not to work and otherwise get ahead. But I've come to the view that it's mostly cultural. That is, we could abolish the welfare state tomorrow. We could indeed abolish all of government tomorrow, and it would have very little effect on the long-term poor. Mm-hmm. They would not suddenly become individualists. They would not suddenly say that they're responsible for themselves. Because that isn't what they believe now, and they're not likely to change that just because government does more or less for them. And in the last 50 years, when poverty has been an issue, we've tried all kinds of different approaches to try to reach this group and motivate it to begin to get ahead, and we really haven't been able to do it. We've had some successes, but in general, we haven't found a way to cause the long-term poor to go to work, to assume responsibility, to see their lives as moving forward and take rational, sensible things to do to move in that direction. We haven't seen that.
Right.
And the reason is that the burdens of freedom are too much for them. To go to work is to assume responsibility for something. And that is very hard. Individual responsibility is a core Western notion, and that is something that we really don't see in the non-Western world. Mm-hmm. We see a much more collective, more passive, reactive idea of what life's about, and that doesn't work in America. You don't find that same collective identity. You're on your own. You have to decide what to do. The opportunities are much better than they were in the old country, but they make demands that you can face them.
Right. So what's the answer? I mean, we have these massive amounts of people coming into the country that are in that very group that will. I don't get by a lot easier in our country than they can in their own, but it still doesn't give them the motivation to become individuals. So,
yeah. See, the very idea of motivation assumes that you yourself conceive a desire to go and do something. And that isn't the way of the non-West in general. They're waiting for orders. They mm-hmm. expect to be told what to do.
Right.
And what I've done in my previous research, I've written several books about this, is to suggest that actually for the seriously poor, we have to tell them what to do. Rather than offer opportunities, rather than offer incentives, or alternatively to deny benefits, those things don't actually give them what they need, which is direction. So actually a directive policy is more effective. And that's what we did in welfare reform. The reason why welfare reform is so successful, I think, and there were a number of reasons why it succeeded, but the core reason, I think, was because we did tell people what to do. We said, you have to go to work now. You can't just draw aid. We'll help you. We're not against helping you. But you must also help yourself. You have to go out and get a job.
And we helped them do that.
Right, but we don't do that now. Now we...
Well, yes, we do. In the program that we reformed, what's now called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, we still have a policy there that says you have to go out and work or look for work if you're drawing aid. Now, there are other welfare programs that don't have those demands, like food stamps or public housing. And there's controversy in Washington now about moving in that direction for those programs. So they would also have work requirements. I would favor that. But the reason why we need the requirements is because this is a fundamentally passive population that isn't going to take action on its own to go out and get ahead. So they have to be told what to do, they'll respond to that more than they do to incentives, because they're coming from the non-West. And the non-West, the one thing it has in common, although there's great diversity in the non-West, all those cultures defer to authority. That's very strange for Americans. We obey authority when it's legitimate, but we also question authority. And the capacity to both obey and question is really central to Western achievement. You don't find that in the non-West. You find deference. So we have to use that. We have to say to people who are poor, people who are immigrants and who aren't making way, we have to say to them, you have to go out and get a job, and your kids have to go to school. And we expect that. And this is not a choice. See, choice is hard. Choice is hard for groups that don't think they're in control of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can't expect choice. But you can expect compliance. You can say to them, go and do this. Now, this is very different from the reaction you get. I mean, I've been on radio and television shows at the BBC in Britain about their welfare reform. And in the British system, people are much more likely to say that they're entitled to money, that they that it's wrong for them to have to work. They assert a right to welfare as an entitlement. Well, our recipients don't talk like that. And the reason they don't is they're not Western. It's Westerners who talk like that. They're the ones who assert rights. And that, I mean, it's arrogant. It's excessive. Those people ought to go out and work. You can have an argument with them, but at least you can have an argument with them. They're prepared to stand up for something. They assert something. That's more positive, actually, than what we see for from our long-term poor. Mostly, most of them are silent. Now, they're spoken for by advocates, but the advocates are not themselves poor. The advocates are assuming things.
Right.
They
That's
are responsible for something, but they're not our problem. It's the people they're speaking for who are silent, who don't react, who don't do anything. See, what's hard to deal with for this group is precisely its passivity.
That's true. That's true.
And it's
gotten even harder. I'm looking at point number six that that Stephen had sent us, that you contend the great divide today is between the individualist West and the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But that the fear of racism has long suppressed dialogue.
Yeah,
I mean, that's like the boogeyman word of the day. Like if
I know,
if they don't want us to talk about it, that you're a racist, and then we're supposed to shut
up. That's right. In fact, I had great difficulty publishing this book because my previous publishers, who were prominent, I had a number of quite well published books,
and they used to like you.
They were terrified by the argument. A lot of people are terrified because it's easy to construe cultural difference as simply euphemism for racism, but it isn't at all. My sources, the scholars of cultural difference, they deny this. No, it's not about race. This is really a different way of life.
Does make us different, and not different. See, they always equate the word different with bad, though.
I'm not asserting that Western culture is superior.
Smart people actually don't assert different with bad. You know, those are the same word.
Yeah, correct. No, the fear of racism is what has suppressed discussion of cultural difference. And the one thing that Trump has done that's constructive here is simply by refusing to honor those taboos. Trump insists upon talking about cultural difference. He does it in scathing terms that are unduly offensive. I can't support his language at all.
He's a New Yorker, you know, and he's a quintessential New Yorker. How about, let's put that fine point on it. And anybody who's dealt with the quintessential New Yorker knows it's just how they do it. It's not they don't like you.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think that's right. New York is not for the faint of heart.
No, they like to fight, which is
correct.
Sort of fun.
But it assumes. But if you read accounts of New York politics, let's say 100 years ago. It was a lot more rowdy. It was a lot more offensive than it is today. Why was that? Because everybody back then was an individualist. And whereas now large parts of New York City, like the rest of the country, are coming from these minority groups that are extremely cautious and deferential. They don't shout. They don't argue. They don't make an issue of things.
Well, besides that, culturally, if you can find a buzzword like racism that makes everybody shut up, you don't actually have to have a good argument.
I know.
You can just throw down and silence them, which is actually kind of handy if you're, you know, trying to do that. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Lawrence Mead. He has written a book called The Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference and American Power. We'll be right back.
Bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps. Now he's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
And if you believe that, you should definitely read this book, Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power, by Dr. Lawrence Mead. Because Larry tells us that's actually not correct.
What's not correct? I didn't quite hear that.
Oh, sorry, the government cheese song.
Government cheese, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's making people poor, you know, and keeping them poor.
I see. Well, it doesn't have a big effect. I think, as I said, if those programs are all eliminated, it wouldn't have much effect on the culture of the lower class, which is the real problem. And again, I'm not saying that viewpoint is incorrect in any general sense. It reflects their life experience. But
sure.
It doesn't get you anywhere. You do, in fact, have to go ahead and take plans and do things that are necessary to get ahead. And you can do that. But it's hard because you have to take more responsibility. You have to decide what your life's about. And that is indeed demanding.
Especially for people who perhaps come here from a culture where that is not part of your upbringing.
And a lot of cultures out there don't assimilate to our culture, our society.
Because we're not giving them any directions.
Right. They come here
we need to do that, but you see, you give direction. The problem with that is it conflicts with our notion that freedom is the answer.
Right.
When you look at how left and right deal with poverty, the disagreement is over whether we should have more government or less, but both sides are selling some version of freedom. And in fact, what has been more effective, according to the evaluations, is directive programs, what I call paternalism, where we help people, but we also say, we tell them what to do. We say, you have to go get a job now, or you have to stay in school,
sure.
or you have to obey the law. And we're unapologetic of demanding that.
Well, and there's a lot of people that are born and raised in this country that fall into that category as well. I mean, I've hired people that, you know, you can turn them on a project and walk away, and they just know what to do. Other people, they'll do what you say, and then they're dead in the water until you give them something else to do, and then they're good at that. So it's the same thing.
Well, that's right. In fact, one of the interesting things I discuss in the book is that part of the native-born population, the low-income and usually low-education workers who voted for Trump, a lot of them are withdrawing from employment and more or less giving up because they find life too difficult now, and they more or less are just abandoning their goals. But when they do that, they're really going over to a way of life more like the non-Western world. And these are people who previously were individualists.
Mm-hmm.
So this shows you how the life of individual seeking and striving is difficult. And for many people, it's too much.
And do you think that's a reason for people going towards socialism rather than, you know, open market values?
Is that why they
actually
think that looks good?
Nope. You see, the socialists are classic individualist moralists. They're trying to save the world. They have a nostrum. They have a recommendation, and they think socialism is the answer. Well, that's what people believed basically 200 years ago and 100 years ago. I mean, there was a long struggle in Western politics over socialism, but it was a struggle fought by individualists, people who believed in things, and went after them. And we now think they were mostly erroneous, that it didn't work, but they tried hard, and their opponents tried hard, and you had a struggle between both sides believing in something. See, that was individualist. And today, the people who want to return to socialism, like some of the Democratic left, they're individualists too. The problem is that is going to change the mentality of people who are giving up.
Mm-hmm.
It'll mean more money given to them and more redistribution and more programs, but that isn't going to cause them to get anywhere.
Right.
Because they're basically against giving those folks direction and having any kind of requirements and to have a plan. You know, there's no conveyor belt onto society.
No, but the idea of a conveyor belt implies that there's some outside force that
That's
can make
I mean.
You into someone, and that isn't true. You have to decide what you want. And from the very earliest point of research on low-income schools, they found out that the kids who get ahead in these schools, even though they're terrible schools, are kids who believe that they control their future, kids who say, I'm responsible. You know, I did well on this test or I didn't do well on this test. And that is why they get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a good school where the students are better prepared and they do better after school and so on, that acceptance of responsibility is automatic. No one questions that. because they've been brought up to bear the burdens of freedom, which include responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what isn't you don't serve that by simply spending more on the schools. You have to change the mentality of the students. And in fact, we do have recently, we had some evaluations of schools that have succeeded in doing that, not primarily because they spend more money, but because they're more directive. They tell the students what they're supposed to do. And they also, they don't offer them choices. They tell them, here's what you're supposed to do. And they keep order. And they're quite unapologetic about that. And those schools evaluate well. Now, it's hard to institute schools like that. They're very demanding. They're tough on the teachers, tough on the principals. It's hard to do it. But if you can get a school together like that, then you are, in fact, promoting an individualist way of life.
Sure. And then when those students get out into society, that's what they understand, that if you want to get ahead, you have to have goals and you have to work towards those goals and not, you know, sit back and wait for it to come to you.
That's right. And that is actually unusual. See, the thing, we think it's a universal way of life, and people who don't do that there's something wrong with them. On the contrary, it's the individualists who are outnumbered. People who live a purposeful life are few on a world scale. There aren't very many of them. And the Western world as a whole is vastly outnumbered by the non-Western world. So most people in the world are sitting around waiting for directions.
Mm-hmm.
They're waiting to be told what to do. And that isn't our way of life, and that's why America's running the world, more or less, because we don't take that view.
No.
But it's not as if others can just adopt our viewpoint like that, because it involves a massive psychological change.
Right. Right. That's why we can't go overseas and in the Middle East and expect them to just accept
our... Go wave a magic wand and make them all like
that? How we live. You guys can do the same thing. It's not their culture.
Yeah. Well, now, there are some cases, though, where capable leaders of non-Western countries were able to reform them in a good direction because they took charge and gave direction. I'm thinking of Ataturk, who became the founding director of what is today Turkey. Turkey was created by Ataturk after World War I, and he tried to turn it into a Western country. He didn't get all the way there, but he made some major improvements. Or Lee Kuan Yew, who was basically the creator of Singapore as it is today. Singapore was a totally backward, corrupt country like much of Asia, and he turned it into an almost modern country. And it's still a collective country, still collective-minded, but it's honest, and they don't have corruption, and they are efficient, and they earn money, and they're prosperous. But that's very unusual. It's uncommon for a non-Western country to be well-governed and to be efficient and modern and so on. Some Asian countries have done that, but they have not done it American style. They haven't done it by broad-gauge individual initiative and people taking responsibility on a personal basis. They haven't done that. Mm-hmm. They do it from the top down. The leaders tell them what to do.
Right.
Now, they also have the market. They have competition. But it's primarily a top-down society where people are waiting to be told what to do, and they're very good at it. And so they achieve something, and they become rich and powerful. But that's not America. America is a society where people innovate on their own. They're out to improve something. They want to make money. They want to get ahead. They also want to fix problems that they see. And they don't wait around for someone to tell them to do it. They just go and do it. And it's that broad-gauge initiative that the historians say is the reason why the West became dominant, why it became capable of running the world.
Well, I think we see that, though. I mean, we can see it within our own society. When government is supposed to be the one that solves the problem, it takes a really long time, costs a lot of money, oftentimes completely misses the point, solves 20% of the problem, if that, and we're wrapped around the axle forever, and the price increases. But if we allow private industry to do it, if we allow just people to figure it out through their own ingenuity, we wind up with amazing things that revolutionize whole industries.
I guess I don't share that view of government. Government is actually
you should work with them more.
In America by world standards, government in America is one of the best governments in the world, according to the World Bank. There are various indicators they have of governmental quality. The United States is right up there. We're one of the best governed countries in the world.
It's not the governing that I guess I'm in the back of my mind. What I'm thinking of is specifically bringing programs to people, and we have some that are great, but we have others that if you just left it alone and let industry take that over, we would have solved it a long time ago.
That's often true, but you see, the criticism of government is to me reflects an individual's temperament. See, that's moralism. We're attacking government by standards that are universal and demanding.
Yeah,
we expect
true.
Government to excel, and we're not satisfied with mediocrity. And that's correct. We shouldn't be. But that attitude, the government is full of people who are problem solvers. I know a lot of them myself.
They're just not always in charge of anything. Unfortunately, a lot of those people are relegated to the... Because I meet them, too, and I'm like, man, how come you are not the boss of this?
Well, there are some functions government has that employ people who have relatively unenterprising views of what life's about. They're not problem solvers. They're holding down a job. They're doing something essential, but they're not engaged in changing the world. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true actually more at the state and local level when you're dealing with routine delivery of public services.
Yeah,
but at
true.
The federal level, there are a lot of people engaging in trying to solve problems and improve government. And government has done some impressive things historically. And that reflects the same attitude that made the country rich.
Right.
So the private sector is great. We have the world's best companies, and we change the world that way. No question about it. But government also does that. You look at the highly efficient aspects of American government. I'm thinking of the armed forces, the Social Security program, the Apollo program that sent a man to the moon.
I'm thinking about the VA.
Well, no, the VA is also a pretty good organization for a massive health program. There are obviously problems, but in fact, we provide health care to the veterans that is, I think, the best in the world, in spite of its limitations. And the veterans are very well treated.
But if they could go into their own communities, they would have the ability to. I mean, the VA has done wonderful things with prosthetics and some of those things that are really specific to care. I take nothing away on that. And some facilities are great, some are not great, but because our veterans, in large part, do not have options, that has given them kind of a monopoly, and the change is very slow and very difficult when you deal with it on the ground. So we have to take a really quick break, I'm sorry, on my little rant there. When we come back, talk to us about collectivism, because we really just kind of skipped over that so we could talk about things we like individualism.
All right. Okay.
But I'm not sure we're super smart about collectivism, and it would be nice not to leave that hanging there.
Okay.
We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Lawrence Mead. Right. He has written a book called Burdens of Freedom, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't do everything, but I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone.
And we're back. Okay, so talk to us about your, as you were writing this and you're comparing the idea of the mentality here in the United States versus a more collectivist idea, what does that mean in your terms?
All right. When I use collectivism, I'm usually referring to a way of life where people are not individualist. That is, doesn't say anything about what government does or doesn't do. Now, the term collectivism is used in Western politics to mean a government that takes over from the private economy, basically, mm-hmm. where government tries to run things rather than leaving them to the marketplace. Now, the idea that you could do that and improve things over the market was a leading idea for about 200 years, from really the time of the French Revolution right up to the fall of the wall in Berlin in 1989, so exactly 200 years. Now, that idea had a lot of influence in Europe and some influence in this country. So we did some things in government to regulate the economy and try to manage it through government. We did that in the Depression in the 30s. We did it during World War II, and we did it in a more limited way after that. So government does involve regulation and oversight of the private economy, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for not good reasons. And that is now been taken up by the Democratic Party. Many of their intellectuals are now saying, let's go back to socialism. But it didn't work in Europe, and it didn't really work in America, because the socialist system is less efficient, fundamentally, than capitalism. And because you don't have people at the top, they're not able to decide how to efficiently use and produce things, as the market can do. So the market, although it has its problems, and you have to worry about fairness and stability and inequality and so on, there are some real limitations to the market, but it is efficient. And it produces innovation. And it makes society much richer than any socialism has ever succeeded in doing.
It also self-purges. And if nobody wants to buy your product, or you're not nice to your customers, we take care of you.
Correct. Yep. So the market has won. That battle has been won by the market, and socialism is really a dead idea. It's coming back primarily because Democrats want to try something new, and they want to in some way provide jobs for people that they don't think have jobs now. And, of course, jobs are already available. So this is a fantasy. It's not something I support, certainly not. Although there's something government does, like the armed forces, which have to be collective. There's
sure.
some things that
you can't have an individualist armed forces, or literally shooting each other in a circular firing squad.
There are some functions that government has to provide that you could call socialist. The VA system is like that. It's a public hospital system, basically, for the veterans. And that is inefficient compared to a private system, but it does. It serves other goals, and there's some argument for it. I wouldn't go back to it. We should recognize that socialism failed in the past, and we shouldn't go back that way. But the point I'm making, though, is that those who are pushing this are not necessarily against individualism. They themselves are individualists. They think they have an idea, and they're trying to sell it to the public. That's very individualist. That's what Americans do. They set out their own ideas about how to do things and try to get support. And it's an assertive, moralistic game. That's what politics is all about. So in some ways, I like that. That's what shows that individualism isn't dead. But it's not a solution to the problem of passivity at the bottom of society.
Sure.
That's the problem I'm focusing on. That's the really serious problem. And we shouldn't be distracted from that by nostrums peddled by people at the top.
Yeah, good point. And so I want to skip to the very last question on our list, that in order for American world leadership to endure, a cultural battle to reinform an individualist America must first be fought and won. And so the nice question here, what can be done to stop the decay of individualism with our own society? Yeah. And what practical steps can people take? Because I think that's always nice to give folks that.
Well, the main recommendations that I make is that we should require people who are receiving benefits to work. We did that in welfare reform. It was a big success. We should do it again for men withdrawing from the labor force. They should not be given disability unless they're really disabled. They should be put to work. We should help them also. They have to be retrained. We have to find a better way to do that. We're not abandoning them, but they can't give up. You see, what Americans want to do is help people who are helping themselves. The idea of reciprocity is very important. So people helping themselves, yes, we will help you. But you can't give up. You can't be passive. You can't go over to essentially a non-Western way of life where you're just engaging in survival. That we do not accept. We do not accept passivity. You have to be part of the team. You have to be out there trying to solve problems. And when you do that, when you take on those burdens, then you are contributing to the country.
And see, I think that's where you run into so much kickback, is when you say people have to work, you know, to be part of the team.
That makes you mean.
Boy, the the alarm bells start ringing at that point. You can't make people work. You know.
Well and so I'll veer off the path here, but I'm just guessing. I already know the answer. But looking at what's happening, not only are you know anybody who's trying to put any common sense in is called a racist, and you know all those other things. Okay, they get called a bunch of names, but with the denigration of men in our society, that's the very popular trend is, you know, men are bad, leadership is bad, and so that's not helping our individualism either.
No, it isn't. But the groups that talk like that or their leaders talk like that are typically groups, the immigrants, minorities, who are coming from the non-Western world. They're people who are uncomfortable here. They don't find it easy to live in an individualist society. So their fatalism, their pessimism, is expressed by the leaders. The leaders, by the way, are not unsuccessful. On the contrary, they're usually very successful.
Right.
These are talented people who are asserting themselves. They're thoroughly American. But what they're arguing for is not American. It's a passivity. It's what they basically say, my group is helpless. We're totally
victims.
Dominated by the society. Well, that is not American. That is the voice of the non-West. That's what people feel like who assign all power to the environment rather than to themselves. And much of the world does feel that way, and it's understandable. I'm not saying that's crazy in general, but it is crazy in America. That isn't what this country's about. We make other demands. We don't ask people to endure the unendurable, where they have outside pressures they have no control over. That isn't our way of life. No, we say, you do have power. I mean, you're also responsible. You must decide what your life is about, and you go and do that. You stay true to that. That is the way you bear the burdens of freedom. That is the demand that we make, and
which
not
is,
a collective demand.
Which is really, and, you know, people think, I don't know, I hear from people all the time, we're so divided, and they assign that all to politics. But honestly, I think the topic that you bring up is also part of the Great Divide.
Yeah, yes, it is. I think that's right.
I think it's more fundamental to the Great Divide, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the groups that come from the non-West that are deeply pessimistic. And that pessimism isn't really coming from America. It's coming from their original countries. They're coming here to escape those countries. And it's understandable they should do that. But they express a fatalism, a powerlessness that we just can't accept. That is not our way of life. And
right.
we really have to say to them, that is not what this country's about. If you think you're powerless, you should go home.
Right.
You know, if you're going to be powerless, you can be powerless in your original country.
Well, what That's they fine. Do, though, is they are dissatisfied, so their their first line of attack is to bring their culture here.
Well, and if we're not unhappy like they are, then we're racists because we're...
Yeah, well, that's the way the advocates talk.
Back to the circle again.
The people who I criticize most are not the outgroups themselves, but they're advocates.
Right.
The advocates talk as if they were powerless, and they are not powerless. They personally are not powerless. They're usually quite successful. These are talented people who are getting ahead in their own way, but they're not helping their group. What they should, rather than describe their group as powerless, they should be saying to them, here are ways we can get ahead. Here are ways we can, in fact, assert some power.
Yeah.
You and your children have to assert power over your lives.
Like we were told as kids, you can grow up and be who you want to be.
Well,
oh, my gosh, I knew an hour wasn't enough time. Dr. Lawrence Mead, we're out of time. But your book, Burdens of Freedom, it sounds awesome. We haven't had a chance to read it yet, but Cultural Difference in American Power.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to go to wethepeopleradio.us, look that up, and read it, and we will have you back.
Well, that would be a pleasure.
Thanks for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For being here.